and welcome to the Asia Business First podcast. I'm Julie Yu, and my co-host Adam Bhatia is still away on the break, but he should be back next week. Filling in for him once again is our deputy chief editor of digital news, David Bottleney. So, David, did you manage to get that special fee we talked about last week for pulling these extra podcast shifts?
The fee seems to be stuck in some bureaucratic black hole, and I don't know what's up with Adam, but I would have thought that spending day after day on your private yacht would get a bit boring, but apparently not. Adam just can't get off that private yacht.
No.
hopefully he'll be back next week. Mm-hmm. Now, earlier this week, the Singapore government announced that it would be raising the goods and services tax from 7% to 9%. But the increase is only expected to kick in a few years from now, sometime between 2021 and 2025.
Yeah, that's about 3 to 7 years away. So that should give us enough lead time to shop for all the big ticket items that we want.
And not just the big ticket items, but the luxury items as well. Now might be just the right time to buy that Rolex that I've always wanted, and Judy, for you to add to your collection.
You know me, I'm just a simple kind of girl, so I'm not really into those kind of stuff. But my husband, on the other hand, is a big watch fan like you, David. So it seems like you guys are not the only one feeling that way, because in fact, demand for luxury watches is at a 5-year high. Shipments of high-end Swiss watches rose 13% to $1.7 billion in January. And it's Asia that's fueling the growth. The region accounted for about 55% of total exports for the month. It's all those crazy rich Asians, I tell you.
I suppose it is, yeah. And it's quite common for high-end watches to cost not just thousands, but tens of thousands of dollars. Now, not many of us can afford that, so it's not surprising that people are, in some cases, turning to second-hand luxury watches instead. The demand for pre-owned watches is so high that even Swiss luxury watchmaker Audemars Piguet wants to launch its own second-hand business.
Wow. So to talk more about this, we have Raphael Tu. He's joining us in the studio. He has written extensively about luxury watches for various publications, including his own blog, Tapestry of Time, Time Tapestry, where you can see his astounding collection of timepieces.
We also have Valerie Tan, a senior consultant from the Great Place to Work Institute. Valerie's going to be talking about something else in just a little while on the podcast, but welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Hi, guys.
Thank you, Julie. Thank you, David.
Raphael, let's start with you. Now, in the US, sales of fancy Swiss watches have been falling, but as Julie just said, in Asia, they've been going up. Now, what's your explanation for that? Why are sales of fancy Swiss watches increasing in this part of the world?
So I think in general, for luxury items, not just timepieces, they've had a stronger growth in Asia due to the higher growth of wealth in Asia. So this growth in the region and the wealth creation has resulted in companies giving more focus as well to the Asian countries to get a bigger piece of the pie here. On the US side as well, looking at the mass market in general, I believe the impact of smartwatches is more pronounced than other regions, together with converged smart devices that display the time, right? Which means watch companies have to think of probably newer, better ways to try and capture the market in the US. So an interesting recent report suggested that Apple sold over like 8 million watches last quarter, which is more than all of the Swiss watch industry in that quarter itself. So from a numbers perspective, and you know, with the growth of smartwatches, I would think that on the US side, it might be a tougher market to crack for the Swiss watch players. Yeah.
So, Raphael, I went to your blog and I was very much wowed by a huge collection of beautiful watches. So is it for collection or investment? Because I hear it's seldom both.
I think there are people that are out there looking at watches as investments. Mm-hmm. But for myself, I would say that I love horology, which is about the art and science of displaying time. And I collect watches not to collect them, to keep them in pristine conditions. I wear them, I enjoy them, and I'm passionate about them and sharing about that passion. Yeah.
For those who are buying watches for investment purposes, how risky is it? I mean, do you need to be an expert in watches in order to get some kind of long-term return on that investment? Or is it just a question of any high-end watch will actually increase in value over time?
looking at watches as investments, right? Of course, there are certain key things that you need to do, right? You have to do a lot of market research on the prices of those watches that you're looking at. And for the watches that you do identify, you have to check on condition, on provenance, make sure that it, if possible, it has its original boxes and receipts and warranties and such, and a good service record as well, because a lot of these watches require servicing at regular intervals, like 5 years or more. So I would say that market research on the pricing of the watches, if you're really looking at it for investment, a lot of people will probably look at potentially auction houses or sites with a view of what those watches transacted at for past prices, and then get a sense on, okay, this is a reasonable range to buy into a certain watch. I would say that a large part of it also depends on how long-term or how short-term they want to hold on to these investments, because some watches may take time in terms of increasing in value. It might require a certain trigger to make it become even more desirable to collectors. So a case in point is the Paul Newman Daytona. So it's a watch where in the past, when the Daytonas first came out, weren't popular. But at a certain point, when it was tied with him and celebrity that he had, then it became of a lot more interest to the buying public. And the prices increased significantly through the 90s and in the 2000 years as well. And, you know, since then, it has gone on a much higher trajectory.
So which other brands would you recommend that could provide the best return on investment? Because I understand that there are only a handful of brands that can actually hold their value and increase over time.
So I will come to brands later, but I would say that the watch brands that provide the best return on investments are the ones with the best marketing strategies, right? And teams that successfully deliver those strategies. A good design, technical strengths are base requirements across the brands. Coming out with a strong DNA of the brand and watches, strong emotional propositions, and the ability to connect, come out with stories that resonate with their target buyers. That is, to me, the differentiator for watch brands that will be able to provide the best bet in terms of return on investment. So just giving examples then of strong brand and watch DNA based on marketing, right? People will believe that certain watches are good as heirloom pieces, right? And of course, certain people will believe that certain watches are good, ultra reliable. They can be used in any sporting or extreme situation. So, you know, when I say these things, in your head, you'll be thinking, oh, there's Patek Philippe for it when you talk about heirloom watches because of effective marketing. There is Rolex, there is Omega when you talk about very good watches that are able to survive extreme sports or extreme situations. So those are some cases in point.
Omega, when time saved lives.
Let's bring Valerie in at this point. Where do you stand on this? Would you be willing to pay tens of thousands of dollars for a watch? Have you done?
Well, I'm too pragmatic for that. And I think the fact that I have a 19-month-old child and, you know, mortgage to pay off and the rest of the life priorities, it's something that I observe from afar. And I think, Rafael, you're absolutely spot on. It is about the brand, you know. It is about the authenticity behind a brand. You know, what's the story? Which brand resonates with me and my perspective of what is quality? Yep. What is its evolution? You know, I think those are things that appeal to me. I think above and beyond that, definitely aesthetics. I buy a watch because it's beautiful. Yeah. I buy a watch because naturally it's unique. So those are kind of the qualities that I look out for if I were ever to buy a luxury watch. At the moment, I have a very modest watch.
It looks
luxurious, but it's modest.
So, Rafael, for people who are buying timepieces, not really for an investment, it's because they genuinely want a nice timepiece. Should people be just going purely on instinct and looking at the aesthetic values of the watch rather than the potential growth in its value?
My advice is always to tell people to buy what they love, right? And if as a result of buying what you love and there's a demand of it in the market, then that's great. But if it doesn't, and you'll end up with something that you love anyway. So aesthetics is definitely key. You only want to find out more about a watch after you see something that you like, right? So aesthetics is a very key thing. From a needs perspective, mechanical watches are anachronisms, right? We don't need them in this current day and age. So it's important to ask yourself, what is it that you're looking for when you get the watch, right?
Yeah. Sure. I mean, let me pick up on that. You call watches an anachronism in the current day and age. To what extent do you think there is a time limit on the watch market, bearing in mind that some people, lots of people, don't even wear a watch anymore? They just carry their smartphone and that's how they tell the time. So do you think there will come a time in the future when people just don't want to buy watches at all anymore?
I don't think that will happen because watches fill certain needs. If you look at like a Maslow hierarchy of needs, right, we're looking at higher order needs that it fulfills, right? We're looking at things that speak to people's sense of achievement, people's view on how successful they might be in a particular field, and they might want to represent that in a nice watch purchase, for example. So I think watches, it's not about function nowadays. It's beyond that, right? We're looking at things that we can connect with. We're looking at things that might mean something to us. For example, if I were to wear a watch through my significant life moments, through my weddings, through holding my first child, I wouldn't want that to be a quartz watch that I will throw away after 5 years or so. I might want to look at something that I can pass to them one day and say that, hey, you know, I was wearing this when I first held you in my arms. Something significant.
Oh, so romantic. Yeah. That's nice. But sticky issue is really money for some people. Let's talk about secondhand luxury watch. Is it worth buying them, and how well do they hold their value?
So I think for the secondhand luxury watch market, it's a huge market, and you have pieces that will have higher demand than supply. A lot of that would probably be looking at pieces that are discontinued, that aren't sold anymore. So for those, I would say that if they are already currently in demand, then likelihood is they will continue to be in demand, and they will likely hold their value within a certain range for the near to medium term. In terms of the other big bucket of watches that's out there, where let's say there's a average demand to supply kind of ratio, and we'll probably look at, let's say, new watches that come out and people want to resell them. It's similar to the Singapore car market, where most first-time buyers will take a hit once they leave the showroom. And so it would be then good to pick up that kind of watch in the secondary market, and I guess someone else takes a bit of a loss on the watch and you benefit from getting in at a better price. For a lot of what's out there that's in that space of lower demand, you can find good buys. But then again, it's about how well they can hold their value over time. So again, go with the stories that appeal to you. Likelihood is that those stories, those connections might appeal to others that are out there as well. Then it's just about finding the right seller at a later point in time. And you probably would be able to get something similar to what you paid for.
How easy is it to buy a watch, keep it until you get tired of it, and then sell it at a profit?
A lot of it, again, depends on that demand for that piece, right? So if let's say that piece, when you went in, was already in high demand, then the likelihood is that when you resell it, that demand, if let's say it's a near term, that piece after 5 years or 10 years would still hold its value probably in that range. Yeah, if it was a piece that wasn't in such high demand, then yeah, likelihood is it might trend downwards, right, in terms of prices. So yeah, it really depends on how sought after that piece is by collectors and people who are interested in these. Yeah.
Val, are you open to buying a secondhand timepiece?
I'm open to the idea, but I think fundamentally, I would probably buy a secondhand timepiece if it's something that I'm not able to purchase off the shops because, you know, it's an old timepiece. Naturally, I'm not the expert in this area, so I'll have to rope friends or experts in. For example, Rafael, I'll probably have to get your number, you know, let me know, is this genuine, is it authentic? But I think fundamentally for me, I think back to the topic on what's the purpose of a watch today. You know, David, you're absolutely right. I use my mobile phone to tell the time, but I wear a watch to start a conversation, just so that, you know, it's easy when you strike up a conversation with someone you've met for the first time, you know, if they're into watches, at least that's a common topic for you to, you know, start engaging in some form of conversation.
Well, let's have that conversation. Let's see who's got the nicest watch around this table.
It's got to be Rafael.
Well, yeah. So, Rafael, what are you wearing today?
I'm wearing an Omega Speedmaster.
Well, that's a fancy watch, isn't it? A really fancy watch.
Yeah, so the Speedmasters are watches that have caught my interest from the fact that they were they're also marketed as, you know, the moon watches, but there's an authenticity to the story behind them around NASA selecting them, right? It was a very tough selection process, and they put it through torture tests. It has a legitimacy, right? Because it wasn't a marketing driven campaign when NASA did that. So end of day, they now have a platform for which to promote the Speedmaster as a legitimately good watch, right? And it is.
Dare I ask how much it cost?
I don't keep track on some of these prices nowadays, but I think the range of current Speedmasters would probably be in the 5,000 to 10,000 range, which isn't so bad. Yeah.
Okay. I suspect that none of us are going to be able to match that But Julie, is that a Rolex you've got on your wrist there?
It's a very simple Rolex called Oyster Perpetual. I don't know much about Rolex.
You're trying to talk down the Rolex there, right? And I'm not too sure that's a narrative that's going to work.
I could wear it on every occasion, with every activity. Not too ostentatious, but still have character.
You're trying to make it sound like a $20 Casio, and I don't think that's going to fly.
It was a gift, by the way.
Sure. Val, what are you wearing?
I'm wearing a Bulova something, something, something. I have no idea what it's called. I could probably Google it, but I got it off a family-run timepiece shop in Bras Basah complex, but I love it because it looks really vintage and it's gold. I like gold.
It does. It's fantastic.
Yeah, and I like the fact that I can tell my date and my day, and the fact that it's an automatic timepiece, it doesn't ever need batteries, so it just requires me to wind. Awesome. So that's perfect.
And David.
Well, I'm wearing a very basic Tag Heuer watch, but I think it's quite interesting that purely by luck, I would expect Raphael, you to have a nice watch. Everyone around this table has got quite a nice watch. So clearly, people are interested and do want to have a nice time.
About luxury.
Well, I've only got one watch. This is it. So there was no choice when I was trying to decide what to wear today. It was this or nothing. But clearly, there is a demand for a nice timepiece.
From watches to watching what your colleagues are up to. Now, this week, there was a pretty interesting report by a local media in Australia that some Australian public servants have been sent a memo encouraging them to tell on their colleagues if they're wasting their time at work, regularly leaving early, or having overly long lunches or coffee break. And the memo urged the staff to inform management about such suspicious behavior and assure them that these reports would be treated as confidential. Now, the memo's argument is that falsifying work hours constitute as fraud, so employees are obliged to help report it. But critics are saying such tattletelling or snitching activities would be harmful to corporate culture. Now, David, I think almost everyone can relate to this report in one way or the other. And as a boss with dozens of journalists to manage, if one of them came to you and snitched on another journalist, do you fear or do you approve of such measures?
I have to say, I wouldn't object to somebody coming to me to say that. If people have concerns about the contribution of colleagues, I think that's a legitimate issue to raise. Mm-hmm. What I think is potentially counterproductive is having such a system institutionalized whereby people are actually obviously encouraged to come up with such information and to tell their bosses about it. Mm-hmm. But that's just my view. Let's bring in the expert view, Valerie Tan of the Great Place to Work Institute. Val, what's your view on this? Is this a good way of inculcating good corporate culture with everybody really working hard?
I think the simple answer is no. I think very much aligned with the workplace expert's opinion, this form of practice really erodes the culture of trust in the organization. And we're speaking about trust at all levels, you know, trust between employees with their leadership, trust between colleagues. You know, a great workplace culture would be one that you trust the people that you work for, you have pride in what you do, and you enjoy the people that you work with. So, you know, if you have such a policy where you're supposed to whistleblow behind people's back, that level of trust is clearly eroded.
But is that not a little bit idealistic.
I think
in any
right.
work environment, everyone knows that there are certain people who work very, very hard, mm-hmm. and there are certain people who don't pull their weight.
Exactly.
And if you are having to work harder because mm-hmm. one of your colleagues is slacking off, mm-hmm. surely that needs to be addressed. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways of addressing that is raising it with your bosses.
Mm-hmm. So I think you're absolutely right. You know, the fact is not everybody contribute in the same manner, but if we dig a bit deeper, why is slacking off something that's prevalent in the culture? And if we dig deeper and ask the five whys, you may actually find that the reason is because management may not have the courage to take people to task. Mm-hmm. It could be a case where the leadership hasn't set the right expectations of what is a required and expected behavior that aligns to, say, integrity. So, I mean, I read the internal memo that was written, you know, by the Australian Taxation Office. Clearly, there's quite a bit of pressure from the external as a public service office. This looks to me like it's desperate times calls for desperate measures from their perspective. It could really be because the pressures from the public, you know, about the integrity of the public servants, you know, the service levels could be dropping. For whatever reasons, you know, that kind of pressures the leadership of the ATO to perhaps start implementing something as absurd as this, that we know that's going to erode the culture, but they have no choice. But maybe it's also because they haven't really gone deep to understand what is actually causing such a slacking off culture. Are there certain responsibility that they must take as a leadership team in terms of managing performance?
But would you say this is tattling is on the rise? Is it more prevalent than before?
The analogy I'll give is the rise of, say, social media, right? So previously, you know, people talk about stuff, but it's never out in public because there wasn't such a platform. So now that there's social media, naturally, you know, people openly talk behind technology. But the conversations, perhaps in 20 years ago, it happens in a coffee shop. So similarly, the whole bit about tattletaling, I don't think it's any different from previous generations. But I think what's different could be the fact that people feel like the ability to assert rights is a lot more prominent in this day and age. And perhaps it's also the fact that organizations have a lot more responsibilities these days. People have a lot more to do, given the fact that, you know, work is a lot more complex than before. And if someone, your colleague's not pulling his or her weight, you know, that impacts on you as an individual. And, you know, under the pressures, under the stress to you, that's unfair. And why is this person not measured by his outcomes, and I have to, you know, bear the brunt of the work. So maybe that gives rise to more conversations around someone not pulling their weight.
So what's the best strategy? Mm. If you're a manager and you have an employee come to you to say, hey, my colleague just across the desk is not doing enough work, mm-hmm. as a manager, should you say, well, could you stop telling me this because you're telling tales on a colleague? Or should you accept the information at face value and do something about it? I mean, how do you deal with these kind of issues in a day-to-day environment?
I think it's basically structured around the values of the organization and the articulated values. What are the behaviors that's expected? So I think, David, to your point, you know, it's an ideal state, right? Whatever I mentioned about a great workplace. But the reality is we do have a good critical number. There are great workplaces that are in that ideal state. And one of the key common traits of these great workplaces is the very fact that they have a core set of values, which they expect employees who are coming into the fold, you know, to embrace it as their own personal value. And that begins from the hiring stage. And then thereafter, they articulate what those values are. So from a management's perspective, it's about your action matching your words. It's also about delivering on promise. And from an employee-to-employee perspective, it is about the fact that, you know, I am fully responsible and accountable for my task. And I understand the impact that I have on my fellow peers if I don't deliver my work. And if I just do the bare basics. So if these these behaviors and the ideal state's not articulated, then it's free for people to interpret. So then managers wouldn't know how to clearly bring about an objective evaluation with someone who doesn't pull his or her weight. And it's hard to bring up the topic, you know, to have that courage to talk to someone if they're not equipped with such indicators from an organization perspective. So I think the common thread behind these great workplaces is the very fact that you need to be outcomes based. You know, these days we are all pro flexibility because the reality is we have many, many different parts of our life that goes, you know, beyond work. And the ability to manage both your work and your life priorities fundamentally make a person more productive. So it goes beyond the fact that you are here physically in the office. You know, it has to do with what is your outputs like. You know, what's the quality of it? What's its efficiency? Are you actually going the extra mile to help achieve a common organizational goal?
Let's see if we can make some of that theory a bit more real and ask something like this. So even in an ideal company, which mm-hmm. has that kind of corporate ethos, which you've gone through there, mm-hmm. even if people are aware of the impact of their own shortcomings in the overall workflow, mm-hmm. whatever happens, there will be some people who work very hard and some people who work less hard. So if you do have a colleague who you perceive to be working not as hard as they should be, what should you do about it? Because I think 9 times out of 10, people will grumble about it and they will moan about it to a peer, but they won't raise it with a manager and therefore nothing will ever get done. Isn't that just the reality of the workplace?
Yeah, I think it is a reality. We have a whole spectrum of workers. We naturally have those who are ambitious, and we naturally will have a handful that are just very comfortable where they are and just delivering the bare basics. I think it goes back to measuring performance. You know, if this person who's delivering the bare basics, are they being remunerated with the bare basics as well? And if they're not, then it brings about feelings of unjustified. And that's why people talk, because the fact that I'm pulling my weight and going above and beyond, I'm only getting as much as the person who's just doing the bare basics. So it's about how do managers differentiate performance. That's really key here. And fundamentally, we've got to ask ourselves in our team, is bare basics acceptable? Because if it's acceptable, then that's okay. If it's not acceptable, then it's got to be something that's called out.
All right. Now, Julie, what's your perspective on this? I mean, have you complained about Adam going off on his private yacht for the last 2 or 3 weeks?
I mean, I would love to join him. Honestly, I try not to engage and I mind my own business, really. I just don't really have the mental capacity to keep track of others, when they're coming in, when they're leaving the office, how long their coffee break is. But I was thinking, while I was listening to you, Val, maybe we can turn it around. And instead of just tattletelling on bad things, maybe we could, you know, positive snitch on people who actually, you know, do more work or, you know, do go extra mile, put in overtime hours like you, David, you know?
Well, that's right. I mean, that sounds very nice. But really, I wonder if that is realistic, that people would actually say, hey, well done, Julie. You did a 14-hour shift and that interview you did was fantastic.
But Julie, you're right, though. So culture, right, is very much influenced by what you elevate. It's very much influenced by what you spotlight on. These days, culture is not built by top down. It's not so much about what the bosses say it's right. Mm-hmm. It's very much encouraged by peers as well, because mm-hmm. if collaboratively we say that naturally we want to highlight what is great, and then that becomes a culture because everyone wants to be recognized. Everyone wants to, you know, be affirmed of the good work that they do, right? So if that affirmation comes out a lot more prominently, then naturally people would be encouraged to want to always go above and beyond. So you're right. I think it can have that culture shift if you do more of that.
Thank you, Val.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think we'll have to leave it there. But let's just round this discussion off by letting me say that, Julie, I think you're doing a great job and your contribution is really meaningful. So thanks very much. And a big thank you to Raphael Tu, Watch Aficionado, and the man behind the Tapestry of Time, Time Tapestry blog. And of course, Val Tan, Senior Consultant. consultant of the Great Place to Work Institute. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
So folks, if you have any pressing questions or topics you'd like us to cover on this podcast, you can reach me on Facebook or on Twitter at JulieUCNA. And remember, you can catch our show Asia Business First every weekday from 9 a.m. Singapore, Hong Kong time on Channel News Asia.
Thanks for listening, and join us again on the podcast in a week's time.